In this weekend episode, three segments from this week's Washington Journal program on C-SPAN. First, Hannah Wesolowski of the National Alliance on Mental Illness discusses gun violence, mental health, and the role of red flag laws. Then, with Tax Day approaching, Government Executive Senior Editor Eric Katz on how the IRS is planning to spend the additional $80 billion in funding from the Inflation Reduction Act. And Cook Political Report House Editor David Wasserman on his research into the sharp decline in so-called swing seats in the House of Representatives. Now, a discussion about mental health and gun violence with Hannah Wesolowski of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
First of all, your organization, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, what is your role? Who funds also your organization? How do you do that?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me
Absolutely. Here.
So NAMI is an organization that provides resources, education, and support for people with mental health conditions and their family members. We've been around for over 40 years, and we really advocate to improve the lives of people affected by mental health conditions.
When you say advocate, how does that work? Are you advocating, obviously, to the public? Do you also lobby state and state legislatures and Congress for legislation?
Yeah, we're a nonprofit organization, but we do lobby to improve systems, to make sure that there's better mental health services in place, that there's effective mental health care programs at the federal level, and then we have 49 state chapters and over 600 local affiliates across the country advocating at the state and local level.
Certainly in a number of the recent shootings, the mass shootings, there have been pointed out that a number of those shooters have had certainly backgrounds or troubled backgrounds with some mental health concerns, some with actually some mental health problems. In the wake of that, the issue of red flag laws, the use of red flag laws has risen in sort of certainly in stature and certain people paying attention to it. Help us understand what red flag laws are and how do they work and what states how many states are using them across the country.
Yeah, so red flag laws are also called extreme risk protection orders more formally. They're civil court orders that temporarily remove firearms from individuals who are displaying risk factors of harming themselves or harming other individuals. Currently, 19 states plus the District of Columbia have these laws on the books, and they've increased significantly in the last 5 years.
How do they get implemented? Who's the person to say to issue that red flag?
So ultimately, it's a judge who makes the decision, but anyone can, not anyone, there are different factors in different states. There's state-by-state laws. So law enforcement in every state can petition the court to remove those guns temporarily. Some states also allow family members to file those petitions, school administrators, in some cases, mental health care providers or other health care providers, and in one case, even co-workers can petition the court to remove those firearms.
You mentioned that family members can petition a court. So if a family member is concerned that one of their other members of the family has firearms, has some troubling issues, what are the steps they should take to do that, to approach law enforcement or approach a judge to say, hey, we're concerned about, you know, my son, my daughter, et cetera, on this, and can we get a red flag law? Can we use the red flag law in that case?
Yeah, the process looks a little different in each state, but essentially you can get an ex parte hearing, which is an urgent hearing in front of the court to remove those firearms for a short-term period. That's usually about 3 weeks, and that'll be followed up by a second hearing with the court where the petitioner will have to testify, and the individual in question would also have an opportunity to present evidence and have their due process. Typically, the period is 6 months to a year that those firearms are removed, and they can be renewed over time. So if after a year the individual doesn't display that they've, the situation has changed, the court can renew that court order.
How do you judge the effectiveness of a red flag law?
There's actually some really good data. I mean, the biggest thing, and as a mental health organization, we look at firearms as they relate to suicide. More than half of all gun deaths are suicide, and it's 90% of suicide attempts by firearm are lethal. It's a highly lethal means of suicide. And Connecticut, for example, has estimated that their law has reduced 1 in 10 suicide deaths as a result of being in place. In Indiana, over 10 years, they've reduced suicide deaths by 7.5% because of their extreme risk protection order law. So,
is there data on who has asked for those red flags? Is it a family member going, say, hey, we're concerned about this person's could be suicidal, could do damage to himself or herself, and other in addition to other people?
Law enforcement has traditionally been the main entity that has requested those. And some of these laws are relatively new in the last 5 years, so there's not a lot of comprehensive data out there on who is making those requests. We know that some of the recent laws passed do allow for a wider spectrum of individuals. You know, family members are a really important part of an individual's life and can identify those, but we know not everyone is close to their family or in daily contact with their family. So making sure we have a variety of options for petitioning the court is important.
After the Covenant School shooting in Nashville, following the political uproar at the state house there, the governor, Bill Lee in Tennessee, signed an executive order on strengthening background checks. And he's calling for a red flag law, calling for that legislature in Tennessee to pass a red flag law. Do you have any idea which direction the Tennessee legislature may go on this?
You know, having the governor speak out in support of this is a really strong signal. And I will say that there were elements of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act that passed last year in Congress that really encouraged states to pass these laws. So this can be bipartisan in nature, and I hope that Tennessee takes that to heart and looks at this. But Tennessee and any other state exploring one of these laws really need to make sure that it's based on evaluating real-time behaviors and not a diagnosis of a mental health condition. Now, people with mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of violence. In fact, a person with mental illness 23 times more likely than their peers to be a victim of violence. So we need to make sure that these laws are based on actual real-time behaviors that a person might be exhibiting and looks at real predictors of violence.
What can we do in the absence of what can gun stores do? What can individuals do in the absence of a red flag law, in the absence of having a diagnosis of somebody with a mental issue, when somebody purchased a firearm that really at that shouldn't be purchasing a firearm, could do harm to themselves and their family member or friends know that this person has firearms, this person is potentially a risk to the community?
You know, another opportunity is gun purchase waiting periods, which really reduce the a lot of the imminent harm that could be done by firearms, particularly with suicides. And some states are exploring that and allowing individuals to opt into that and really making sure that they're not able to purchase a firearm if they're fearful that they are going to be suicidal and have suicidal ideation. So those are some other things that we can implement. You know, The concern that we always have is that the focus is on mental illness. The United States is not the only country that has mental illness. This is common around the world, and yet we're the only country that has this public health crisis when it comes to gun violence. Only about 4% of violent acts are attributable to mental illness, and so we really need to look at the larger picture of how we're limiting the use of firearms to cause this harm, both to individuals and self-inflicted harm, as well as larger mass acts of violence.
All right,
That was Hannah Wesolowski of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Next, with Tax Day approaching, new reporting on how the IRS is planning to spend the additional $80 billion it's getting from the Inflation Reduction Act. Here's that discussion.
As we all know, it is tax season, and here to talk with us about the IRS funding and staffing is Eric Katz, who's a senior correspondent with Government Executive. And in particular, on your story, Eric Katz, on the IRS's plan to hire nearly 30,000 employees over the next 2 years. You're reporting at govexec.com. Why is the government, why is the IRS want to hire this many employees?
Well, IRS says that it's been chronically understaffed, underfunded for going back 10, 15 years. And they're trying to correct for that. Congress provided $80 billion spread out over the next 10 years to boost its roles and to give it the resources that it says it needs desperately. They're trying to focus this on better enforcement for high-earning individuals and corporations, and also to make taxpayer services better. So, you know, if you call IRS with a question, they'll be able to answer your call more quickly. They can help you actually get your taxes filed correctly and on time. That's sort of the goal, and they've been unable to do that for many years.
You report, in your report, you break down some of the numbers of that $80 billion, $47 billion of it in tax enforcement efforts, $7.5 billion in taxpayer services, a $12 billion boost in technology improvements, $4 billion in energy security, and the hiring part of that is $8 billion. But on the technology improvements, it's a pretty big number, $12 billion. What does the IRS say is needed on their end in terms of technology improvement?
Yeah, so a lot of their systems are old, and they're kind of scattershot. So there's not like they're functioning off of one system in particular. They're actually have a lot of different mechanisms that they use to accomplish their goals, and they want to consolidate that, modernize that. They want to make the user experience better. So when you go on, there's like sort of one portal where you can, put in all your information, get your taxes filed, track how your return is coming, and you can see that process. You know, a lot of people complain now. They submit their filing for the year, and then they just have to sit back and wait. They don't know exactly when they'll be hearing back from IRS, so making that more user-friendly, making it so their systems talk to each other better, all these things that will make their operations sort of function more smoothly, both on the back end for the IRS and on the front end for the user experience.
How big of an organization is the IRS? How many employees?
Right now, they have somewhere around 80,000 employees. And that number has declined since 2010. Roughly, it's gone down about 15,000 employees overall, and either enforcement personnel, they've lost like 30,000 or so. So it's been there are much lower levels than they have been from their peak.
You report in your report, and government executives say the IRS plans to bring on about 10,000 new employees in the current fiscal year, most of whom will focus on taxpayer services. In the next fiscal year, 2024, the agency will double that to nearly 20,000 hires with $1.4 billion and the plurality of the new staff going toward enforcement. The Treasury Department released its plan several weeks ago after a self-imposed deadline, drawing the ire of many on Capitol Hill. Where was the opposition and why to this plan?
So, kind of multi-parts to that. First of all, they were opposed to the $80 billion at all because they say the opponents of that spending, Republicans mostly, say that will lead to sort of unfair targeting of everyday Americans. Obviously, part of the ethos of the Republican Party is less taxes is good, so more tax enforcement can sort of be problematic to that view. They're worried about adding staff and what that will mean for, small businesses who might receive more audits or, the Biden administration keeps saying this will only increase audit rates for high earners, but, will there be trickle-down impacts for middle-income individuals? So there's the concern there. And then there was also pushback in the delay of getting this plan out and detailing exactly where the spending is going to go. And even after they put the plan out, there was some pushback in terms of lack of specificity and long-term goals and for things like hiring. You know, you mentioned this year, next year, they spelled that out. But, you know, what will that look like 3, 4, 5, 6 years down the road? We don't have those details yet.
It sounded like the $10,000 this year, taxpayer services, so they really want sort of a frontline engagement with taxpayers to be their first priority then.
Yeah, that's right. The administration is hoping that the original hiring spree will go toward helping, like I was talking about, the user experience, answering the phone calls, dealing with people's questions as they come up. Then later on, they'll sort of get to more of the hiring on enforcement, actually people who do the investigations into people's taxes and auditing those returns.
That was Government Executive Senior Correspondent Eric Katz. Next, Cook Political Report House Editor David Wasserman on his research into the sharp decline in so-called swing seats in the House of Representatives.
Let's start with real basic swing district. How do we define it?
Well, traditionally, the Cook Political Report has defined it as a district that has a partisan voting index score of between R plus 5 and D plus 5. These tend to produce the most competitive races, and we've tracked this over the past 25 years. In fact, we just came out with an archive that's available on cookpolitical.com for every Congress dating back to 1997. And what we found is that the number of swing districts has fallen in half in the House, from 164, which was the high point in 1999, just 24 years ago, to just 82 today. And that's attributable to a combination of voters self-sorting. We've seen increased polarization between urban and rural parts of the country and voting patterns, and voters choosing to live in places where the vast majority of their friends and neighbors agree with their political values, and also redistricting and the tendency of both parties to engage in gerrymandering. But what we've seen is that Republicans in recent decades have had an advantage when it comes to drawing the lines, and they've been able to gerrymander more states than Democrats. And so Republicans have been able to increase the number of safely Republican seats, seats that are R plus five or above in redistricting years, whereas recalculating these scores to reflect election results has tended to see a rise in Democratic-leaning district. Now, as far as how we actually compute these scores and determine what's a swing district, we look at the results of the presidential race by congressional district. And we use the two most recent presidential election results for every 435 districts, and we take the difference between that result in the district and the national result. So, for example, a district with a score of R plus 4, maybe the Republican candidate nationally for president got 49% of the vote. We might expect that in this district they got 53% of the vote.
So R plus 4 is whatever happened last time, and then you add to it as far as the final figure is concerned.
Right. And, you know, we use a greater weight for the more recent presidential election. So in our current PVI scores, we weight the 2020 election at 75% of the score and the 2016 election at 25% of the score.
160, you said, as far as swing states, that's down to 80 plus. What does it mean then for those competing in those states for various political offices?
Well, it's had a profound impact on the incentive structures that members of Congress think with when they're casting votes. Keep in mind that it used to be that 164 total of swing districts, that was greater than the number of either solidly Democratic or solidly Republican districts. And now, 82 out of 435, that's less than 20% of the House. So that means that over 80% of members of Congress are being elected from districts where the primary is tantamount to election, and the November election is a foregone conclusion. That means that the overwhelming share of legislators are playing to a primary base because their only threat politically would come from someone who's, if you're a Republican, further right than you are, or if you're a Democrat, someone who's further left than you are for the most part. So this has meant that most of the competition is now in states that have maps that were drawn in a more neutral manner, not by partisan legislators who were seeking to maximize their advantage. And there are 18 states where maps in the most recent redistricting cycle, 2021, were drawn by either a nonpartisan or bipartisan commission or a court. So the battle for the House is increasingly going to come down to states like California, Arizona. New York has a court-drawn map. These are the real battlegrounds for 2024.
These trends that you saw, or at least in this latest analysis, could you go back to the last House election and see, particularly as a result of what happened as far as the close margins that we saw, is that because of anything you're seeing on the swing states or what's going on at large?
Well, we had around 45 to 50 competitive races in 2022, and that tracks pretty well with the number of seats that we have in our PVI range as hyper swing seats, those between R+3 and D+3, the ones that are kind of closest to the national average. And we would expect that around that same number of seats will be competitive this next time around. Now, keep in mind, there are now 18 Republicans who hold seats that Joe Biden carried in 2020. There are 5 Democrats who hold seats that Donald Trump carried in 2020. And those are going to be at the top of either party's target list next time around. Part of that is that Republicans, despite underperforming what history might have suggested they should do in the midterms, they managed to do quite well in both California and New York. And so in New York State alone, you have 6 Republicans who represent slightly Democratic-leaning seats compared to in the past when they had only 2. So Democrats see their route back to the House majority as running through those 6 Biden Republican seats in New York, 5 in California. There are 7 in other states. And yet part of the challenge for Democrats is that Republicans could go back and redraw maps in other states. At the same time Democrats picked up seats in North Carolina and Ohio last fall, Republicans took back control of those state Supreme Courts. And that's important because state Supreme Courts were the ones who invalidated Republican gerrymanders in the first place last time around. If the new state Supreme Courts green light Republican legislators in North Carolina and Ohio to go back and revisit those lines in the middle of the decade, in time for 2024, that could give Republicans an additional 5 seats in the House and double their cushion, effectively, considering they're sitting on such a narrow majority.
And the trends you're seeing just for the House, you don't see anything as far as statewide or happening on the local level. This is just really for House elections, or I guess it impacts local elections too.
Well, look, this trend's across the board. We're seeing a decline in the number of swing states, swing districts, swing counties, swing neighborhoods. You know, take counties, for example, where we haven't really seen the boundaries of counties change in recent decades. And yet in 1992, 61% of American voters lived in what we would, only 38% of voters in 1992 cast ballots in what we would call landslide counties, counties that gave either party's nominee more than a 20% margin for president. Today, that number is 58%. So we've seen Americans increasingly live in communities that are politically homogenous. And, you know, I think that's a result of polarization along educational lines, the fact that we've seen Democrats doing better and better with those who have 4-year college degrees, and those voters have tended to cluster in urban and suburban settings. And you've seen kind of a hollowing out for Democrats in more rural parts of the country. For example, Kentucky's 5th congressional district. This is coal country in eastern Kentucky. Back when we first came out with our index in 1997, this was an R+1 seat. It was very close to the middle of the House. Today, it is the 2nd most Republican district in the country.
Dave Wasserman here for this conversation. He's with Cook Political Report. Remind people quickly about what the report is and how they can gain access to it.
Sure. So the Cook Political Report is a nonpartisan newsletter analyzing House, Senate, gubernatorial, presidential elections. We were founded by Charlie Cook in 1984. Amy Walter is our editor-in-chief today, and I've been covering House races at the Cook Report for the last 16 years, and we meet with candidates. We talk with consultants and ad makers in each party. We talk with the party committees who are spending a lot of money in these races, and we also take a quantitative analytical approach to demographic trends, election trends, and try and balance and calibrate all these factors into our outlook of which party is likely to do well in each seat. And so you can find all our analysis and subscription information at cookpolitical.com.
That was David Wasserman of the Cook Political Report. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.